The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the August 4th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Was the Renaissance real? We celebrate the period as a golden age of cultural rebirth, but two new books argue that the Renaissance, as we imagine it, is little more than myth, by Adam Gopnik. With minimal ingenuity, any historical period can be made to dissolve into the ones around it. Take the Rock Revolution, that great shift which, emerging in the mid-1950s and established by the mid-60s, definitively separated the Broadway and jazz-based tunes that had previously dominated popular music from the new sound. The break ravaged record companies and derailed careers. In the 50s, the wonderful jazz and standards singer Beverly Kinney performed a song she'd written called I Hate Rock and Roll. And then, perhaps for other reasons, but surely for that one too, took her own life. But listen closely, and you hear continuity stronger than any rupture. The second song that the Beatles sang to the American public was a Broadway ballad from The Music Man. Chuck Berry, their hero, worshipped Nat King Cole, with Berry's great rock songs of the 50s being variants on Cole's witty hipster jazz songs from a decade before. Berry also took most of his guitar licks from the sophisticated jazz guitarist Carl Hogan of Louis Jordan's band. And the elements of Leonard Bernstein's or Richard Rodgers' music within the best work of a Paul Simon or a Paul McCartney are as obvious as is the intertwining of Miles Davis and Jimi Hendrix. It was in the record business interest to convince the teenagers to whom it was selling music that their music was nothing like their parents' music. But the rock revolution can easily look more artifactual than authentic. To anyone who grew up in the period, this is a bit absurd. Of course, the rock revolution was real. Of course, the rock era was an era with signatures and styles all its own. The first song that the Beatles sang was self-composed, in itself a huge change. By 1967, when Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Bob Dylan's Visions of Johanna were wildly popular, the musical world had become completely different from what it had been a few years earlier. Still, attempts to dissolve a period, however unpersuasive, can be instructive, because they make you think hard about what a period style is. Your common sense goes to war with your critical theory, as it should, since the point of critical theory is to puncture what we call common sense, while the point of common sense is to see past theory to things as they are. As with rock music, so with the Renaissance. Beginning in the mid-19th century, when many educated Europeans and Americans shifted their model of a great good place back then from ancient Greece and Rome to Renaissance Italy. This reevaluation coincided with 19th century asceticism, the idea that art could rival faith as a reason for living, and with a revived appreciation of material progress. Renaissance people didn't just think things, they made things. And so celebrating the Renaissance became a way to pay respect to prosperity and materialism. When Walter Pater published The Renaissance in 1873, he was implicitly aligning Botticelli with William Morris and the Craft Revival. Two decades later, when the art historian Bernard Berenson praised the tactile values of Italian painting, he was linking Giotto to the pragmatism of William James. Yet doubts, of the kind that halo the rock revolution, have always hovered around the idea of the Renaissance. If it was really a rebirth of a classical past, Why are its greatest monuments all Catholic affirmations of faith? If it marked a break with medievalism, well, what medievalism? Dante and Petrarch's clear vernacular preceded what we now call the Renaissance. As the art historian Erwin Panofsky long ago observed, Europe saw many renaissances in classical form long before the 15th century. The rounded arches of Romanesque architecture in the 12th century, for instance. Perhaps the Renaissance appeals to the modern imagination because it was an invention of the modern imagination. Two new books from university presses take up this debate for the 21st century. Berndt Ruch's The World at First Light, published by Princeton, translated from the German by Patrick Baker, runs to almost 1,000 pages and, despite its title, actually offers a kind of macro dissolution of the Renaissance. Seen from Ruch's vast aerial perspective, the period vanishes into the whole of history, much as Manhattan shrinks to just another island in a satellite view. The Renaissance, in his telling, fades into the medieval world that spawned it and the Enlightenment that followed it. Meanwhile, Ada Palmer's Inventing the Renaissance, published by Chicago Press, at a mere 650 pages, announces its thesis in its title. Hers is less macro-dissolution than a series of micro-disillusions. She goes deep into the minutiae of the lives of Renaissance luminaries to show that, far from being idealists reaching for the rebirth of a better world, they were the usual human mixture of self-promotion, self-delusion, and fakery. The Renaissance cities, far from being principalities of prosperity and enlightened rule, were desperately poor, violent, and anarchic. They turned to antiquity more for consolation than for confident renewal. The Renaissance, in Palmer's view, was a series of idiosyncratic local arrangements. It was given a shine later by those who needed something shining. Pater's The Renaissance has about as much of a relationship to actual 15th century Florence as Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado does to 19th century Japan. Where Ruch sees the Renaissance as a broad spectrum of activities, rock is just one episode in the long history of pop music, Palmer argues that under close scrutiny, the whole idea collapses into contradictions. Rock is not an actual thing, but a series of retrospective reflections around different things. For Palmer, then, the Renaissance is not so much a golden age as a glittering illusion, assembled, reassembled, and ultimately undone by the longings of those who came after. Ruch's Renaissance begins in the 12th century, the High Middle Ages in our usual accounting, and carries the story through the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, and the Baroque. A professor emeritus of history at the University of Zurich, Ruch has written a book with an almost comically wide reach, in the spirit more of Jaron Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel than of a conventional cultural history. In a diamond-like manner, Ruch even devotes many speculative pages to the Little Ice Age as it was experienced in the 16th century. He credits it for the surge in witch hunts as failed harvests set off mass panic. That's surely overdrawn. After all, A Midsummer Night's Dream was written in the chill of it. The book's scope is partly academic mission creep. Ruch seems to know of every human being and social movement in Europe through those six centuries, and he wants to write about them all. He also adds in Asia and Africa throughout. This dots the book with delightful and animating cameos. We meet the first man since antiquity known to have celebrated his birthday. As sure a sign of individualism as Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. and learn that the library in the great ducal court of Urbino took manuscript books off the chains that had traditionally held them in place, allowing the reader to move them back and forth within the room. Even a longtime lover of Carpaccio's 1502 picture of St. Augustine in his study, the greatest image of a humanist at work, might not have noticed that, for all the serenity of the study, the expensive books are actually strewn across the floor and under the desk, spines every which way, just as in a modern scholar's study. It's a tiny, but telling sign that a new idea of reading and thinking was taking hold. Inevitably, a net this large hauls in a lot of sardines along with tuna. In Ruhrk, everything comes in for scrutiny, and everything is not really a subject. Many pages go by that seem scarcely pointed toward a point, but a thesis does in time emerge. And it is that the Renaissance was neither the last effusion of the antique past nor a beautiful preliminary to modernity. It was modernity itself. The key ideas, social practices, and convictions that made the scientific revolution began here. The version of the Renaissance beloved of Pater or John Ruskin, a lyrical overture to beauty and communal order, refined by classical aestheticism, is, on this view, sentimental. Instead, the period marks a permanent alteration in what earlier scholars would have called European man, forged through a new union of artisanal craft and intellectual ambition, and shaped by the competitive world its makers inhabited. It is impossible to imagine Thomas Aquinas actually building a Gothic cathedral. But Leon Battista Alberti and Leonardo were profound neoclassical and proto-scientific souls, and also guys who could engineer cannons and bridges and churches. Filippo Brunelleschi knew how to think buildings and how to build buildings. Galileo ground lenses as much as he theorized the movement of the planets. These pursuits were necessarily communal. It takes a guild to make a telescope, and helped develop horizontal social structures that shaped egalitarian, even democratic habits, which then helped reshape the world. What marks a Renaissance man is not multifariousness of pursuits, but rather an intensity of purpose so great that it has an appetite for all sides of a single activity. This combination of practical skill and intellectual ambition inspired the scientific revolution. The marriage of the tenaciously artisanal and the wildly speculative eventually produced, among other things, Charles Darwin's painstaking pigeon breeding, the groundwork for his theory of evolution. And, though democratic states were still a distant prospect, democratic habits flourished within guilds, faculties, and even monasteries. Renaissance people were not conscious egalitarians, but they were accustomed to open contest and competitions, one of the hallmarks of modernity. Ruhrk goes on to address the great question of why Europe became the center of prosperity and innovation on the planet. Colonialism and imperialism can't explain it. They're as old as time. Ruhrk believes, surprisingly, that the Renaissance, and so the breakaway of Europe, happened not in spite of the era's religious warfare, but in part because of it. By fusing spiritual and temporal power, the period's absurd-seeming battles over mystical doctrine, was the blood truly present in the chalice or merely indicated in it, were inseparable from struggles for worldly authority. The result was an enduring instability which, however brutal, prevented the dead calm of enforced harmony. Ruhrk contrasts this, in a grand Spenglerian manner with the East Asian spiritualities that, he insists, tended to make a neater division between what was owed to the divine and what belonged to the state. Necessity may be invention's mother, but chaos is its father, as he was the begetter of the Olympian gods. In Rook's picture, competitive rather than imitative habits of mind rose from religious warfare, establishing a cutthroat system of cultural and economic innovation, which lasts to this day. We expect to fight for our lives even as we are living them. The Renaissance began this remaking. Palmer, a historian at the University of Chicago, has no such Spenglerian horizons, but instead drills down into the lives of her favorite subjects, which include herself. Palmer, who also writes science fiction and fantasy novels, becomes a recurring character in her book, sharing personal anecdotes and memories of favorite professors. Her tone aims for chatty irreverence. She refers to the Florentine rulers as the nine dudes in the tower. Palmer's personal voice is part of an academic trend toward making scholarship more confessional and transparent. "Now you understand my biases," she tells us after recounting her own history as a student. Still, the key to first-person address, as that great Renaissance master, Michel de Montaigne, understood, it is not to subtract complication, but to supply it, registering doubt, hesitation, and irony even while developing an argument. Palmer manages this at times, but too often the self-presentation feels obstructive, like a friend sending selfies from Florence, positioning himself cheerfully in front of all the things he's been gazing at. You're glad to share his delight, but you'd quite like to see the Duomo. Yet, many are the charms of Palmer's books. She argues, in contradiction to Rook, against what she sees as the 19th century idea that each age has a defining spirit and that the Renaissance was one great movement growing toward its mature form, modernity, reducing other modes of thought to remnants. The Renaissance, she insists, was, in fact, plural, and our modern age is just as plural. Or perhaps the pluralism of Renaissance civilization is exactly what makes us see it as having begun the modernity we share. Palmer's demonstrations of this pluralism are mostly compelling. She recenters the Renaissance within the double natures of its various principles. Lorenzo the Magnificent emerges as an unmagnificent, ambivalent figure. Palmer also knows how to make a minute story matter, as in her explication of the needlessly and ostentatiously ornate Latin of the era's scholars. Far from shedding the scholasticism of the medieval mind, they were, she shows, actually aggressively obscure. Where Dante and Petrarch wrote in the vernacular, their Florentine successors ran away to unreadable language. Palmer's purpose throughout is to take the humanism out of the humanisti, as those who taught the Greek and Latin classics were called. There was, she explains, no particular humanism to them, in our sense. The later meaning is a pinback by those nostalgic 19th century admirers. On certain subjects, though, Palmer seems weirdly off base. She insists, for instance, that the Renaissance hierarchy of evidence put authority foremost, logic second, and observation at the bottom. But Leonardo's notebooks, which are surely as Renaissance as it gets, are nothing but observation. His drawings, however stylized, strive to capture what whorls of water actually look like, so much so that the art historian Irving Levin found that they matched with uncanny precision our contemporary understanding of hydrodynamics. Leonardo was really looking, Palmer also claims that the Renaissance had no idea of progress. But the first modern art historian, Giorgio Vasari, whom she scarcely mentions, was preoccupied with progress above all. As the art historian E. H. Gombrich reminded us long ago, Vasari's whole project was to chart the technical advances in representation which culminated in Michelangelo. It soon becomes evident that these blind spots are a consequence of how historians of ideas, like Ruch and Palmer, relegate the visual arts to the background, treating them as illustrations of intellectual change rather than as engines of it. Yet, as Gombrich and his students, Michael Baxendall first among them, made clear, painting was where the action was. The steady addition of new techniques, linear perspective for space, aerial perspective for distance, anatomical precision, meant that even if philosophy and medicine remained static, painting was energized by a powerful sense of technological progress. The shift in what was possible for a Florentine artist between 1410, when Fra Angelico was painting his toy-like and schematic landscapes, and 1510, when Michelangelo was painting the creation of Adam, was without precedent in European history in any domain. This, surely, is the true originality of the Renaissance. For the first and perhaps the only time, the arts, and especially painting, eclipsed science and philosophy as the main site of intellectual energy and advancement. The pictures tell us more about the age than the age can tell us about the pictures. You might have to labor over the Humanistes Latin, but Botticelli requires no translation. The magnetic force of the birth of Venus and Primavera has been evident since they were painted. Enigmatic they may be, but that's their purpose, not their problem. The energy of a world remade, where spirituality and sensuality are mystically entwined, radiates from them. In the realm of the visual, the Renaissance Humanisti became humanists in our sense, almost by accident. What the painters learned from the past gave them license to enliven their work with faces, bodies, and desires. The writers might have been trapped in the old tongues, but the painters had eyes left free to imagine. Though painting and sculpture were the primary movers, they were not the only arts that counted. Galileo's father, a lutenist, took part in heated debates with fellow musicians and argued through experiments like hanging weights from lute strings to test their tension. Even in music theory, the idea of progress burned brightly, well before physics had caught up. We sense in the father the son's later irreverence, a willingness to challenge received wisdom, to pull the strings and see what sounds got made. There is a constant paradox of art making. As an art form accelerates its pace of change, its content grows more nostalgic. This is evident in the work of the other great warp speed era, French avant-garde painting between 1870 to 1914. As painting raced from sunlit impressionism to cubist abstraction in a single generation, its subjects looked backward to Gothic cathedrals, to a bohemian cafe table culture already passing away. It is the speed of transformation, as much as anything transformed, that makes some periods of human civilization permanently compelling. New things come from old things newly seen. If the Enlightenment aimed to grasp the world as it is, the Renaissance balanced the world as it once was with the world it was becoming. That double consciousness is what gives the pictures and their period their grace. Botticelli's people have the wistfulness of exiles, in Potter's beautiful phrase. Their melancholia was the uncertainty inherent in a time of enormous change. That spirit, to return to our original tune, wasn't unlike the spirit of those disruptive rock records, which, in retrospect, were about longing for a lost England or for a vanishing America of trains and outlaws. Renaissance painting occupies a similar space between the magical and the material, or, if you prefer, between the medieval and the modern. The same space that Shakespeare occupies and that makes him the last of the Renaissance masters. It's this double consciousness which remains so lucid to us today. They knew that nothing was solid beneath their feet, even as the stars shifted above their heads. Doubt, as a form of sociability, as another Renaissance scholar calls this feeling, brought people together to share their uncertainty and moves us still. It fades into this and fades into that, Chuck Berry wisely said when he was mapping the innovations of his music. Most people's impressions overlap other people's impressions, and music is like that too, he added, shrugging off the charge of being either an absolute innovator or a mere conservator. Sometimes the speed of art simply accelerates. One might prefer, sophisticated modern taste often does prefer, the simpler things, like the pre-Raphaelites more than Raphael, as much as we prefer vinyl to Spotify. But the painterly resources available to Raphael were vastly larger than those available to an artist a scant half century before, as the musical and lyrical resources available to a pop musician in 1970 were incommensurable with those available to a pop musician in 1960. Style is necessarily hybrid, but there are times when cultural speed really gets supercharged in ways that draw on the past to create something new. If we are trying to come up with a word for such times, it isn't crazy to call the world they make reborn. Next, from the June 30th, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, the case for Zohranomics. As some Wall Street billionaires melt down over Zohran Mamdani's policy platform, a prominent progressive economist argues that it meets the moment, by John Cassidy. Panics about the supposed threat of socialism or communism are hardly new to American history. So the reaction in some quarters to the presumed victory of Zohran Mamdani, a self-described democratic socialist, in last week's New York mayoral primary, wasn't surprising. It's officially hot commie summer, the hedge fund billionaire Dan Leib wrote on X. A bit more shocking, perhaps, was the response of the Harvard economist Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary during the Clinton administration, who accused Mamdani of advocating Trotskyite economic policies, which was presumably a reference to his calls for a rent freeze, free bus rides, government-run grocery stores, and higher taxes on millionaires and corporations. Summers also said Mamdani had shown a great ability to learn during the campaign and expressed the hope that he would provide much-needed reassurance to believers in the market economy. To be sure, these reactions to what might be called Zohranomics didn't exactly stun Mamdani's supporters, many of whom take criticisms from financiers and centrist Democrats as confirmation they are on the right track. Summers never disappoints, does he? Isabella M. Weber, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, who signed a public letter endorsing Mamdani's campaign proposals, told me during a lengthy conversation last week. Weber rose to prominence during the COVID-19 pandemic when she called for government price controls and published detailed research about how big companies were taking advantage of the global emergency to raise their prices and profit margins. Responding to Summers' comments, she said that describing Mamdani's program as Trotskyite was absurd and didn't tell us anything about what Mamdani's agenda is trying to get at. In the open letter, which The Nation published a few days before the primary, more than two dozen progressive economists from the United States and other countries described Mamdani's policy platform as a bold yet practical blueprint to tackle some of New York City's most urgent challenges, above all, the cost of living. Weber told me that she felt Mamdani did very well in presenting himself as someone who stands up for the affordability of life and focuses on what I have been calling essentials, the stuff that people can't do without: housing, food, transportation, and childcare. If you can't afford that stuff, you are really pushed to the margins of society. Weber contrasted Mamdani's proposals with the equivocations of Joe Biden's administration during the nationwide cost of living crisis that Donald Trump and other Republicans successfully exploited in last year's election. She recounted how Biden, in his 2024 State of the Union speech, denounced corporations for capitalizing on a period of crisis by increasing their prices or reducing the size of their offerings, but then didn't do much about it. After Kamala Harris replaced Biden on the Democratic ticket, she proposed a federal ban on price gouging by food suppliers and grocery stores. But she subsequently rode back on the issue, Weber recalled, based on pressure from similar quarters that had been criticizing Mamdani's campaign. The critique of Harris's proposal was that price controls don't work, and the same charge is being hurled at Mamdani's call for a rent freeze on roughly 1 million rent-stabilized apartments. The freeze wouldn't apply to the city's million or so market-rate apartments. In a controversial column that favored Andrew Cuomo over Mamdani, but took aim at both, the New York Times editorial board said that a rent freeze could restrict housing supply and make it harder for younger New Yorkers and new arrivals to afford housing. The argument is that if landlords and developers see a rent freeze, they would be deterred from investing in new affordable housing. When I put this point to Weber, she said that it was important to realize that Mamdani's call for a rent freeze is accompanied by a pledge to build an additional 200,000 rent-stabilized units over the next 10 years. His campaign plans to accomplish this by expanding public investments, changing zoning laws, and fast-tracking planning approvals. If you only do a rent freeze without ensuring that you also build, I don't think that's a great idea, Weber said. Given the severeness of the affordability crisis in New York City, the combination of a rent freeze and an aggressive build-out of affordable housing is a good idea. Creating more affordable housing is hardly a radical new mayoral goal, of course. In 2014, at the start of his 8-year tenure, Bill de Blasio also unveiled a plan to build or preserve 200,000 affordable apartments. And in 2021, his administration announced that it had achieved this goal. Arguably, the most successful expansion of the city's affordable housing stock came with the construction of public housing projects, which began during the Great Depression under Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, who established the New York City Housing Authority, NYCHA, and continued in the post-war decades. Subsequently, federal funding dried up and public housing came to be associated with crime and other problems. In recent decades, New York's mayors have built affordable housing primarily through public-private partnerships in which for-profit and not-for-profit developers receive tax breaks and other forms of support for putting up buildings that are privately managed. Mamdani's website says he will recommit to public housing, doubling the city's investments in major renovations of NYCHA housing, and using NYCHA-owned land, such as parking lots, as sites for more affordable housing, a proposal that de Blasio also championed. That sounds sensible and overdue. But the housing shortage facing the city is formidable. Some recent studies say it needs to build as many as 500,000 new homes. Mamdani has put less emphasis on encouraging market rate development. He has given a few nods to the abundance wing of the Democratic Party, such as pledging to eliminate parking minimums and encourage development around subway stations and other transport hubs. But the primary goal of his plan is to unleash the public sector to build housing for the many. Another objective is to provide the city's residents with cheap and healthy food. The Mamdani campaign says that its new grocery stores would operate in city-owned buildings in low-income areas that currently lack adequate options, so-called food deserts. It went on, without having to pay rent or property taxes, they will reduce overhead and pass on savings to shoppers. Before moving to Massachusetts, Weber once lived in the Sunset Park neighborhood of Brooklyn, where she sometimes found it difficult to shop for healthy foods. The price dimension of Mamdani's proposal is important, but the other is the accessibility of nutritious food, she said. It's important to note, as some media accounts haven't, that Mamdani is proposing a pilot scheme of just 5 new stores, one in each borough. In a metropolis with more than 15,000 privately owned supermarkets and grocery outlets, this seems like small beer. Nonetheless, Weber said that the experiment could be valuable. If it succeeded, it could be expanded, she noted. And ultimately, it could encourage more competitive pricing in private stores. If you have an alternative that is reliably cheap and doesn't take advantage of opportunities to raise prices when they occur, that can change the pricing dynamic for whole sectors. That is potentially an important advantage that comes from having a public option. In many people's minds, the term public option is associated with health care. But public transportation is a public option, too. And as Weber pointed out, the proposal to make bus rides free fits in with Mamdani's emphasis on basic needs. Affordable transportation options are essential for your basic material well-being, to get to a job, make money, and earn a living, she said. Some progressive thinkers and groups have extended the public option concept to other areas, including communications, financial services, and food retailing. In a recent article that cited Mamdani's proposal on grocery stores, Becky Chow, the director of policy and research at the Economic Security Project, wrote the following. Public options show what's possible when governments respond to local communities' needs and build real alternatives for their constituents. When we grapple with the imbalance of power in our economy and focus on market-shaping solutions that constrain corporate power while building power for all Americans. Of course, public options will only succeed if they deliver what they promise. For example, there's no guarantee that city-run grocery stores would be able to provide cheaper and more nutritious foods. That's why you need a pilot, Weber acknowledged, to see if you can pull it off. Another of Mamdani's proposals is more familiar to mainstream Democratic policymakers and likely more consequential all around, universal child care. During the 2020 election campaign, Biden called for federally financed child care for all children aged 3 and 4. After he was elected, he included a version of this proposal in his Build Back Better plan, which failed to make it through Congress after Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema opposed it. Mamdani, according to his website, is promising to provide free child care for every New Yorker aged 6 weeks to 5 years, ensuring high-quality programming for all families. This plan builds on de Blasio's establishment of universal pre-K, which was the signature achievement of his mayoralty. Weber pointed to studies showing that child care programs, which already exist in places like France, Sweden, and her native Germany, generate positive outcomes for parents and children alike. She said that the city at large would also benefit from them, because fewer families would be forced to leave when they have children. I can think of 3 off the top of my head that moved out because it was completely impossible, she said. It's really important for New York as a place. That's surely true. But how realistic are Mamdani's proposals? One obvious issue is cost. Earlier this year, the group New Yorkers United for Child Care released a plan for statewide universal coverage that it said would cost $12.7 billion a year. The Mamdani campaign hasn't said how much its plan for the city would cost, but if it was half that figure, it would expand the city budget by about 5%. To help pay for his spending proposals, Mamdani says he would raise the city income tax rate by 2 percentage points for individuals earning more than $1 million a year, and by increasing the state corporate tax rate to 11.5%. Cuomo, pushing back on Mamdani's proposals, claimed that the tax hikes would prompt many rich people and businesses to flee, thereby undermining the city's tax base. At least one recent study of millionaire migration patterns suggests that the threat of tax flight has been exaggerated. But it's certainly true that Mamdani, in order to get his tax proposals enacted, would need the support of Governor Kathy Hochul and the state legislature. They wouldn't only have to support it, they have to initiate it, a longtime state official and observer of Albany politics told me. And it's great to say you're going to introduce free bus rides in New York City, but you don't run the MTA, which runs the buses. The governor appoints most of the MTA's board. Financial experts say that Mamdani would also have to get state approval for the extra $70 billion in municipal bond issues that he is proposing in order to pay for his affordable housing program. These realities of New York politics partly reflect the state's constitution, originally adopted in 1777, which devolved some, but by no means all, powers of self-government to the city. The next mayor, like so many of his predecessors, will have to engage in awkward negotiations with politicians in Albany. This isn't necessarily a hopeless position. The official noted that de Blasio, after being elected in 2013, eventually received a good deal of state funding for his electoral platform, which included universal pre-K. And this de Blasio success came despite the fact that he had an awkward relationship with Cuomo, who was then governor. That's normal Albany politics, the haggling, the back and forth, the observer said, adding that Mamdani has a good chance to get a good chunk of his agenda through, but he's unlikely to get everything. That's only one assessment, of course. Catherine Wild, the chief executive of the Partnership for New York City, a business leadership group that represents about 300 companies in the city, gave me another one. Since the primary election, Wild said, she has been spending a lot of time reassuring senior executives that Mamdani wouldn't have the authority to push through his proposals, particularly the tax ones, so they don't freak out and move. Wild went on, "We have every confidence that the governor will make clear to him that his tax agenda is a non-starter." Weber questioned the notion that wealthy people could leave New York en masse. She said that having an apartment in a desirable part of Manhattan is a status symbol that they value highly. And she added that folks on more modest incomes are more sensitive to rising costs. If rent costs become too high, and transportation and food, they do end up leaving. For the super rich, the calculus is completely different. She did grant that Mamdani will face some major obstacles if he gets elected, but that hasn't sapped her enthusiasm for his candidacy, which she regards as a model not just for New York mayoral hopefuls, but for any politician seeking to counter the rise of Trump and other right-wing populists. At the end of our conversation, I asked Weber how she would describe Zohranomics. As municipal socialism, perhaps? Or municipal Rooseveltism? "I'm not sure we need to search for isms here," she replied. "If anything, it is a very effective form of anti-fascist economic policy. We are at a moment where the crisis of economic security, of affordability, that comes with basic questions of dignity and identity, are being used by the far right in ways that fuel the return of fascist tendencies. I think that having an agenda that is laser-focused on the needs of ordinary people is what we need. And that is basically where the Democrats fell flat last year. At the federal level and the global level, we are dealing with the consequences of that lack of vision right now." Next, from the July 9th, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, "Is there still time to be hopeful about the climate? Scientists have long insisted that we can and must limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, and some still do, even as that grim milestone nears," by Daniel A. Gross. For the past 5 years, a red digital clock the size of a bus attached to a building in New York City's Union Square has been counting down to zero. Climate Clock, the group that installed it, describes the time that remains, about 4 years, as the most important number in the world. It represents humanity's shrinking opportunity to limit global warming to a long-term average of 1.5 degrees Celsius, or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Earth is already hot enough that climate disasters are spreading and intensifying. In the past week, deadly heat waves have broken records, and flash floods have killed more than 100 people in Texas. But it will get worse. The UN's Committee of Top Climate Scientists, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, the IPCC, warns that every additional tenth of a degree makes forecasts more dystopian. Megastorms escalate, sea levels rise more sharply. And so, in the Paris Agreement, nearly every nation on Earth agreed to work toward the 1.5 degree target. Climate Clock called it a point of no return. Unfortunately, it is also where we're going. Last year, the hottest ever recorded was about 1.55 degrees warmer than the world before the Industrial Revolution. Long-term averages are lower, perhaps 1.36 degrees, depending on how one measures, but they are rising rapidly. Scientists usually measure temperature at the Earth's surface and average it over a decade. So, by the time they confirm that the line has been crossed, it may be behind us. Global emissions haven't even started to decline from all-time highs, and President Trump is taking months off the clock by jackhammering pillars of environmentalism, such as the Inflation Reduction Act and the Environmental Protection Agency. Current policies mean we would have 3 degrees C of warming by the end of the century, Piers Forster, a physicist who co-authored several landmark IPCC reports, told me in an email. What we should do is acknowledge that our inaction or insufficient action has generated death and destruction. Marina Romanello, the executive director of the Lancet Countdown, a research initiative focused on health and climate change, said, "That is a cross that we will have to carry." The moment the line is crossed, she added, should serve as a grim occasion to renew global ambitions. It's not to give us more space or time or wiggle room, she told me. It's about keeping temperatures as low as physically possible. The knowledge that we can't afford to crash past 1.5 degrees Celsius and that we are on track to do so nonetheless has sparked a debate about whether the goalposts should move. It would be a huge mistake to deviate from 1.5, Johann Rockström, the co-director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, told me. Beyond that point, he said, there's an escalating risk of climate tipping points, the collapse of ice sheets, the disruption of ocean currents, the sudden thawing of permafrost. He preferred the metaphor of a landing zone. The more we overshoot, the rougher the landing, and the more we'll struggle to remove carbon from the atmosphere in the future. If we readjusted the target every few years, any sense of urgency would be lost. Jean-Pascal von Yipzerelli, a former vice chair of the IPCC, said, "Even if it's difficult to make highways safer," he pointed out, "no leader would ever set a target of hundreds of thousands of traffic deaths per decade. Why aim for the lethal levels of warming?" One problem with countdowns, and with points of no return, is that they don't tell you much about what comes afterward. I think we need to be honest about where we're most likely headed, Daniel Swain, a climate scientist who studies extreme weather at the California Institute for Water Resources, told me in an email. Best case scenarios from a decade ago are, unfortunately, probably off the table. He urged not only emissions cuts, but also adaptation to a hotter and more dangerous planet. The climate crisis has been described as a ticking time bomb, but this gives a false impression that the bomb has not gone off yet. In truth, we are not so much working to defuse the explosives as we are trying to contain the blast. Still, Swain argued that a second number in the Paris Agreement, well below 2 degrees centigrade, could still be reachable with a fight. The good news is that we know how to get there by phasing out the coal, oil, and gas that caused the crisis, by protecting the ecosystems we depend on, by electrifying buildings and vehicles, and, as Bill McKibben wrote on Wednesday, by scaling green energy sources such as solar. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, a marine biologist and climate advocate, does not identify as an optimist. Even so, she is the author of a book called What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures. When I asked her about the 1.5 degree target, she told me, "Some people feel like if you exceed it, it's all over and you can just give up." But the difference between a narrow miss and a big one, she went on, could be hundreds of millions of lives. It could mean whether or not the places you love continue to exist. At well below 2 degrees, coral reefs struggle to survive. At 2 degrees, they may simply go extinct. All I can really come up with is, like, don't be a quitter. Why are we giving up on the future of life on Earth so effing easily? Johnson said. Where's our tenacity? Where's our fortitude? We can do hard things. And finally, some poetry. From the July 28, 2025 issue, Rift by Arthur Sizz. As you tie shoelaces, a driver runs a stop sign and crashes into a van. Before dawn, a lightning flash, then a torrent of rain. An archaeologist unearths a whistle in the shape of a maize god emerging out of a flower. Living on a float house, you reeked of yellow cedar smoke. You see a great blue heron perched on the float house railing, stretching its wings. Under a streetlight, a raccoon on hind legs stretches and sniffs a mailbox. Hail and rain reverberate on the roof like staccato chords. At the equinox, sunlight slants across a pyramid and forms along the nine tiers, a descending serpent of light. We dilate each other's eyes. How is it you shed earlier selves and are more yourself with each shedding? In defeat, you were thrown to the muck and dazed, got back up, determined, reinvigorated. In defeat, you quickened to the pulse of a river. A pianist leans over the keyboard, about to detonate the silence. Aroma of pears scattered in the grass. You followed the thread of poetry out of a maze into sunlight. We revel in physical existence. We revel in the mysteries of worlds inside this world. Water drains off the roof as dawn opens a rift of lapis lazuli sky. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.